The opinions voiced in this program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, and financial advisor or tax advisor prior to investing. Investment advice offered through Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management, a registered investment advisor. Welcome to the Financial Focus Radio Show with your hosts, Tyler Simonis and Josh Finelli. Join us as we discuss markets, bring transparency to issues within the financial services industry, and bring honest, thoughtful analysis every week.
Hey, everyone out there. Thanks for joining us on Financial Focus Radio. One of your hosts, Josh Finelli, and my partner, Tyler Simonis, will be joining us in the back half of the show. We'd very much appreciate you spending some of your limited time with us. And if you do have a question for the show, remember you can always email us at josh or tyler@northwestquadrantwealth.com, and we will answer it during one of our email segments. Or alternatively, you can call our office, 877-670-7117. It's been a while since we've got a voicemail, so I would appreciate some of those. But as always, we'll jump right into it with our market update. S&P 500 finished up the week up 1.4%. The NASDAQ outperformer up north of 3%. Of course, we had the SpaceX IPO last Friday. It dominated market conversation. We had a new Federal Reserve chair and resolution or temporary resolution memorandum of understanding over in Iran. So tons to talk about this week. Small caps up 1.5%. Developed international markets marginally lower, down about 0.25%. And emerging markets led by China up 2.6%. Over to the oil markets. Oil was down 14%. All those oil bulls got absolutely crushed this week. Barrel of West Texas Intermediate crude settled in around $75 a barrel. Gold had been having a great week until Kevin Warsh gave his first press conference. I will talk about that a little bit more in a minute, but gold ended up marginally higher, 0.3%, $4,245 an ounce. 10-year government bond yields 4.45%, down a bit on the week, and 30-year government bond yields here in the United States at 4.9%, down about 0.1% there. We'll get right into the summary of the – we got some economic data. Retail sales were up almost 1%. They were at a two-month high in retail sales growth. And pending home sales, the big outperformer, up 3.8% last month. That was versus estimates of just 1%, up 4.8% year-on-year. So seemingly a flurry of activity in the real estate market. Hearing that also from local realtors that are clients. So it's not just unique to Bend. But that's pretty sparse on the economic data front because, of course, the big subject that, that we have this week that I'll touch on first is maybe temporary resolution of the war with Iran. We're already starting to see signs of normalization in the Straits of Hormuz. There's, you know, of course, a massive backlog of crude and LNG tankers in the Persian Gulf. Supposedly, according to Bloomberg, there was 31 super tankers, which, you know, VLCC, a very large crude carrier, carries about 2 million barrels of oil each. So good for north of 60 million barrels of oil preparing that had turned on their transponders and were preparing to exit the strait for Asian refineries. Tankers all over the world, as was the resolution was broadcast, started changing directions and, you know, in the middle of their voyages, going all over. So, you know, are we going to see a resumption of hostilities there? You know, the president sort of tipped his hand there saying, you know, inventories were essentially 4 weeks away from being exhausted on the refined product space, which you know, led to sort of this outcome that, you know, it's objectively like really hard, you know, to sort of characterize it as a win for the United States in the long run. you know, I tend to be more of a neocon, and I can't say that you can really characterize this outcome as something that we really fulfills the intended intended outcomes that we wanted. But really, it just kicks the can down the road. Doesn't really give a definitive resolution for anything. There's an immediate economic benefit to the Iranians in that they'll, of course, be selling oil immediately on global markets. I can't say that I'm not frustrated and feel like there was a little bit of a lack of messaging here, that if, you know, we were going to enter into this kind of conflict, that the outcome should have been more clear. But the economic impact is going to be immediate. Gasoline prices have fallen below $4 a gallon for the first time since March in the majority of the United States. Of course, an exception here if you live here on the West Coast. There's definitely a lot of bipartisan pushback, it seems like. There's more developments to come, of course. A resumption of hostilities would, you know, lead to the same outcome that we saw in March and April, which is dramatic run-up in prices. But, it's clear, and in retrospect, I think it was obvious to anyone that, you know, was affiliated in the shipping industry. There was tankers moving the whole time, just not that many. I saw as of Friday at Lloyd's List, 18 had already crossed the straits Friday morning. So global oil markets are going to return. Whether or not you'll see a full resumption in the previous aggregate volume of traffic leaving the strait, or whether or not it will result in sort of a reorienting of exports through various pipelines or other contemplated infrastructure, you know, that could be the lasting impact. Because now that the Iranians know that they have, you know, this choke point, and this is a critical juncture that basically gives them veto authority on any sort of deal, you know, are they going to exercise it again? It seems very reasonable to assume that they would. But moving on to the second big topic of the week, of course, Federal Reserve Chair Kevin Warsh, his first meeting as chair of the Fed. And wow, for market participants, market nerds like me or Tyler, you know, this was kind of crazy. It's so much different than Jerome Powell. Jerome Powell was just an extension, you know, he's a registered Republican, but very much an extension of the same sort of communicative style and ultra low monetary policy stance that his predecessors, Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke, had been. And, you know, he really wanted to telegraph what the Fed did and set, you know, their entire belief system was predicated around steering expectations and managing expectations. And what that meant for a lot of market participants is, you know, there was this presumption out there that the Fed is willing to depress volatility by promising certain policy responses. And what we call that in the markets is the Fed put. And you remember, of course, the famous Fed put back in COVID, March of 2020, when the Fed ripped out all the stops, started buying corporate bonds, juiced the money supply in unprecedented coordination with the Treasury. And so what Warsh seems to be telegraphing, and, you know, when I sort of parse what he's saying, he seems to be telegraphing that, you know, by virtue of communicating less, he wants to sort of maybe erode the false confidence that distorts the cost of capital and encourages recklessness when participants feel like the Fed put exists. And I think from, you know, an existential level, like, doing that is actually really important. And, you know, whether or not he'll be there long enough to actually enforce this change is the real, the real question. But I really like seeing that. I don't, you know, the market sold off right in the midst and after the post press conference on Wednesday. And, you know, I don't think he was really hawkish. He wasn't dovish. So, you know, he wasn't advocating for higher or lower rates. He was very parsimonious, but also very decisive in saying that, you know, the committee is united and determined to bring inflation down. And he pledged that the committee would unambiguously and unanimously deliver price stability. So it seems like he's more on an emphasis of, actually reducing inflation, trying to get us back to that two handle, but is not quite willing to walk himself into the category of being a quote hawk. But from an overall standpoint, I think that what this is going to do is introduce a little bit more volatility into the market's reaction function around Fed decisions. Because all of the Fed decisions under Jerome Powell, you knew what they were going to be 3 months ahead of time, and you definitely don't know now. So the market can easily find itself offsides, I think, under a warsh Fed.
Get your free one-hour retirement review. Meet with a Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management Investment Advisor today for free. It's our offer to you as a listener to the show. Give us a call today to schedule your portfolio review. 800-743-0988. Again, 800-743-0988. Connect to the Financial Focus radio show on YouTube or iTunes. Listen to past shows, get our bi-weekly e-news, and keep up to date on the market. You can also sign up for our e-newsletter on our website, northwestquadrantwealth.com. Let's get back to the show.
Hey, everyone out there. Thanks for joining us on Financial Focus Radio. Wishing you a wonderful weekend. I know I have really been enjoying the World Cup and the College Baseball World Series. Knicks Championship was pretty cool, too. So it's been an awesome summer so far for sports. As always, if you do want to be a part of the show, just give us a ring at 877-670-7117. Drop us a question or shoot us an email at josh or tyler@northwestquadrantwealth.com. If you have $750,000 or more in investable assets and you'd like a free retirement review, give our office a call at 1-800-743-0988 and we'll get you on the calendar. Well, before I forget, I was talking about the new Federal Reserve Chair, Kevin Warsh, last segment, and I made a bet with our producer. We have a history of very good bets here on Financial Focus Radio. They're always on a knife edge, it seems like. Like, we pick time, we are very good at picking time horizons for the Dow. You know, we'll bet on stuff like Dow to hit 50,000 and everything else. And they're always like, the resolution comes down to like within a few days. And speaking of Kevin Warsh, I'm not sure the president is going to get what he thought he was going to get. You know, so there was a lot of animosity on the left around Kevin Warsh being a sock puppet or whatever else. And after watching him yesterday and, you know, also sort of seeing the sum total of his work product over the years, he is a classic Milton Friedman school economist, which is not going to play well, I don't think, in the Oval Office. And so I bet that the president, I bet the radio, radio producer, I'll take the under. 6 months, he's going to be apoplectic, raging, raging pissed at the Federal Reserve, and I'm giving it it's June 19th, so before the end of the year. 6 months, he's going to be raging pissed. That's the bet. All right. Well, the wealth inequality in the United States is very complicated. You know, you always hear these arguments around the middle class is shrinking. You know, my partner is a huge advocate of the sort of K-shaped economy, where there's the upper class versus the lower class. And there's a lot of Foucaultian level class dynamics playing out. But one of the true things, and this is in the data, that's happening that I think is underestimated by some, especially on the, you know, left to center political leanings, is that the middle class is shrinking. More people are actually entering the upper middle class than are sort of falling behind. And American households are getting richer, but the rich are getting richer at a faster pace. And this data from Pew Research Center, the upper middle class is now the share of families in each class. As of the end of 2024, so 2025, the latest that they have the data, 31% of American families fall into that upper middle class characterization. It was 18% It was 21% in the year 2000, and it was only 10% back in 1979. Of course, there's a lot more rich people, but the level of people that are poor or near poor in this country is now only 18%. As recently as 2001, it was 25%. And in the latter half of the 1970s, it was almost 30%. So we are reducing the amount of overall poor people. More people are entering the upper middle class or lower upper class, so to speak. But this giant vehicle of wealth creation that is the capital markets is diffusing throughout the economy. And I think another reason to be very optimistic. Another interesting stat from the data this week, this is courtesy of S&P Global, but there's an interesting dynamic unfolding here. There is a bit of a manufacturing renaissance in the United States to the extent energy prices have been materially lower here than our big geopolitical competitors in both Asia and Europe. Manufacturing costs, are predominant – energy inputs are a predominant driver of manufacturing expense. So what's flipped actually is that services PMI business activity and U.S. manufacturing PMI output have flipped. So manufacturing growth is actually leading services growth, which is just a total affront to the dynamic that we've really seen since COVID, where the opposite was true. So I'm heartened to see that. I hope it continues. You look at some of the high frequency indicators like flatbed rates and everything else are shooting through the roof. So it looks like, this AI boom is diffusing throughout the economy. Another thing I wanted to touch on briefly before I jump into a conversation about rebalancing is Morningstar just published Professor Bessenbinder over at Arizona State. He just updated his data, 100 years in the U.S. stock markets, and he studied the roughly 30,000 U.S. stocks that have existed between 1926 and 2025. And based on his latest update as of the end of last calendar year, he found that less than half of stocks actually posted positive returns and just 41% outperformed the U.S. Treasury bills, which is crazy. And here's the even more mind-blowing stat, in my estimation, is just 46 stocks accounted for half of the $91 trillion in wealth that the market has created. And what the best part of it for me is looking at what those stocks actually were, and he broke it down by percentages of this $91 trillion, leading the way. And I think that every boomer portfolio on the West Coast I've seen owns this, is Apple. Apple alone is responsible for 5.5% of that $91 trillion. NVIDIA, relatively recent phenomenon, of course, is 5% of that. Microsoft's 4.5%. It's all the usual suspects. And then you sort of go down the list. Tesla's, Amazon's, Berkshire Hathaway's a little over 1% of that $91 trillion in wealth creation. But then it's some old stalwarts. You have GM, Coca-Cola, Altria Group, the former parent of Philip Morris, IBM, MasterCard, Costco, Home Depot, Cisco, AbbVie, Johnson & Johnson, and even Procter & Gamble and Merck. Lilly, of course, has rocketed up as their share price has ripped higher. But it's very interesting. You think about the reality that most people don't understand that. Yes, you're going to have one winner, but if you don't allocate enough size to that one winner, it's not going to make up for the 40% that the 60% that underperform treasuries. So portfolio construction and having indexing be sort of the basis of your portfolio construction is really important for the average retail investor out there. It is very, very hard to consistently be right, especially when you look at, Warren Buffett now trailing S&P on a 14-year basis, which are very difficult to do over time. Well, I just wanted to briefly touch on rebalancing. A lot of our clients have asked us whether or not we plan to rebalance recently. And, we have not done a rebalance for quite some time. We've done some reallocation in our fixed income portfolios, but remember, the purpose of rebalancing is to maintain a portfolio's risk and return, not to maximize returns. But the more, and this is what I wanted to convey and what I've been conveying in client meetings is, the more frequently you rebalance, the more you're going to negatively impact your own returns. But rebalancing for us is a rules-based process, and we're not going to do it based on sort of the emotional sentiments around wars or AI bubbles or anything else. It's just relative to our own rules. And our threshold-based rules have not been triggered, and we're going to keep letting our winners run.
Sign up for our e-news today. Get the latest thoughts on the market every other week from Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management delivered right to your inbox. The short 5 to 6 minute video helps you keep up with the market. You can always watch past videos on YouTube or on northwestquadrantwealth.com. Listening to Financial Focus Radio Show, where you get honest and actionable advice every week from the partners at Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management. Remember, you can always listen to past shows on iTunes or find us on northwestquadrantwealth.com.
Hey out there, thanks for joining us on Financial Focus Radio. I'm your host, Josh Finelli. My partner and co-host, Tyler Simonis, join us for the second half of the show, wishing everyone a wonderful sunny weekend. Well, this one is from the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association and Macro Bond. More T-bills and more dependence on the Fed. Treasury bills, so that's issuance on the very front end of the curve, now account for almost 85% of gross Treasury issuance. That's the highest share in over two decades. And the Treasury, by tilting issuance towards short-dated debt, the government ties its borrowing costs more closely to the front end of the curve, making financing increasingly dependent on Fed policy. So interest rate increases or decreases, the Fed funds rate that we talk about so much on the show that they held steady at the meeting this week, that's at that 3.5 to 3.75% bound. That dictates, you know, the overnight financing rate for banks, but it's also sort of where the government predominantly issues its debt. That decision really started under Janet Yellen. I think that, you know, the previous Treasury Secretary was betting that there might be some significant rate cuts going into a potential win in the election. That didn't pan out. But then more and more issuance sort of flooded to the front end of the curve, which just makes our interest expense potentially more volatile. You know, we talked a ton about the Fed meeting in the first couple segments of this show, but it's increasingly clear that this Federal Reserve, this new regime under Kevin Warsh, is not going to telegraph what they're going to do. And I think the big implication for that is that the positive implication is that over the long run, if the Fed sort of harkens back to this, which was a policy for a lot of years, it should reduce moral hazard insofar as it would, you know, preclude market participants from believing that Fed policy is essentially going to bail them out. Because when market participants think the Fed's going to bail them out, they just engage in completely reckless behavior. No one wants to see that. That's I think, the big positive implication. The potentially negative implication is that the market is not going to really know what the Fed is thinking at any given time, which can lead to, I think, a lot higher degree of volatility around potential decisions that may catch investors offsides. And, you know, yesterday was not, I think, a response to that. I think the market might have initially interpreted it as being hawkish, meaning higher rates, but then very quickly was like, wait, he didn't actually say anything about higher rates. So maybe a reassessment, which is why I think the bounce on Thursday was pretty predictable. Markets, of course, closed on Friday for the Juneteenth holiday. Well, this one was from Jeffrey Pataka at Morningstar. 9 out of 10, a do-nothing portfolio that froze the largest active hedge funds holdings and never traded the funds themselves, beat the funds themselves in 9 of the 10 years to 2025, including the down years of 2018 and 2022. So when market volatility stares you in the face, doing nothing is oftentimes the best action. Crazy to see a statistic like that emerging from hedge funds. Well, this segment, the genesis of it was an email from a client over in Eugene. He is in his early 60s, roughly $2.5 million in gross assets spread out across both pre-tax, Roth, and non-qualified, so a joint brokerage account with his wife. And he said, sent me an email from 24/7 Wall Street with an article, and he just said, why does this not apply to me? And the article was, why a 65-year-old with $2 million should claim Social Security at 62 and not 70. And this was actually a financial advisor arguing to this effect. And, you know, it's certainly a big place of contention. It's one of the, you know, the constantly oft-litigated debates within the industry. When markets are doing well, you know, the big argument is, you know, take the money and invest it. That's what we always hear. We'll often hear that from clients or prospective clients, you know, because I can get way better than that 8%. And in the market, and you know, it harkens back to that Dave Ramsey, go find yourself a good 12% growth mutual fund. But and, you know, this client in Eugene, if he filed at 62, would sort of fall into that 2/3 of males out there that file as soon as they can for Social Security, and that, you know, why we try to get people to delay. And, you know, I highlighted the potential 4.7% cost of living adjustment rider that Social Security is likely going to have during the next benefits update. Why we try to get people to delay is because, you know, you add that COLA on top of that 8% growth, risk-free growth in the payment stream between those years of 62 and 70. It's more about how, and so much of this gets wonky, and that it's the psychological impact of having an annuitized income stream that really helps people. And yes, it's true that, you know, the median life expectancy, and here's where you can get also very wonky with medians versus means and everything else, but the median life expectancy for males in the United States is barely past that break-even age of waiting to 70 to file for Social Security. So the argument is, you know, you're only going to live on the median a year past the break even. Of course, you're going to break even. You know, for most people, you're going to break. You're waiting to 70 is going to pencil mathematically. And I totally do understand, actually, the argument for people that are relatively short on retirement assets, that filing early, whether it's at your full retirement age or a couple years before, if that money is going to make a meaningful impact on the most important years of your retirement, and it's going to be qualitatively different, like a major, major change or major increase in the standard of living you can enjoy, then yes, like I appreciate the reality that those dollars can get you to where the next 5 years are going to be the best five through the duration of your early retirement, when you're the most active, when you're doing the most things. And so I can appreciate that in certain limited circumstances, and it's typically applicable to those that don't have sufficient assets, that filing decision, you know, made in conjunction with a financial advisor, it can be the best plan. And so, you know, that's, I think, the only really real category of people, apart from those that, you know, maybe don't have any, you know, any visibility into their long-term health because of, you know, potential hereditary, you know, heritable traits that, you know, my father and or mother didn't live very long, and or I'm very unhealthy and I don't anticipate living that long, you know, which I think is also overestimated just by virtue of how many times I have that conversation. But, you know, again, the only people that should really do that, you know, most people out there dramatically underestimate how long they're going to live. And I mentioned to this client, like, he's a fit guy that spends a lot of time walking and, you know, doesn't have children actually. So the drawdown on his portfolio assets that are eventually going to be passed on to, you know, his non-child beneficiaries, all of these things argue for trying to build up the form of that annuity stream payment, because that annuity payment in the form of Social Security, it's going to liberate you from withdrawals later. And that's the key component of it, is because it's guaranteed, that's the liberating psychological aspect of it. That's the whole argument for fixed annuities in general that has some validity, is that that fixed payment stream is what liberates people to go ahead and spend. And so, you know, I think that that you can't really quantify that value, and that's why it's so underestimated. But, you know, the other thing I wanted to touch on is the politically motivated aspect of this, which, you know, we're electing 33 senators in November that are going to actually have this unpleasant distinction of being the first U.S. politicians who have to deal with automatic Social Security cut benefit cuts while in office. You know, actuaries at the SSA are saying that fourth quarter of 2032 is when the old age and survivors insurance trust fund will run dry, and that's entails an automatic reduction in checks by a fifth. But remember, no politician, red or blue, is getting reelected on the basis of cutting Social Security benefits. So I just can't reasonably foresee that happening.
Get your free one-hour retirement review. Meet with a Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management Investment Advisor today for free. It's our offer to you as a listener to the show. Give us a call today to schedule your portfolio review. 800-743-0988. Again, 800-743-0988. Thank you for joining Financial Focus Radio Show. Honest, transparent analysis brought to you every week by Tyler Simonis and Josh Finelli. Call the show anytime at 877-670-7117. We'll try to answer your question on the air in the following weeks. Now, back to the team from Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management.
Hey out there. Thanks for joining us on Financial Focus Radio. Well, last segment, I was talking. I'm your host, Josh Finelli. My partner, Tyler Simonis, and co-host will be joining us for the second half of the show. But just to give a quick recap of the last segment, we were talking about Social Security, the case for filing early versus the case for delaying. And, you know, that so many filing decisions these days are motivated by, you know, that warning that you see, and it's now starting to prevail. It's a very prevailing narrative, really, that the Social Security automatic benefit cuts that are pegged for the fourth quarter of 2032 are motivating that decision, because I paid into this. I deserve it. I'm going to take it now. And, of course, we have an election coming up in November, and 33 of those senators are going to be around for that six, you know, their 6-year terms, that they're going to be voting on the decisions that ultimately impact the viability of the program going forward. And I would just caution people out there from making a decision predicated on the belief that benefits are going to be cut. And that was, so I just wanted to continue sort of that aspect of the prior segment, because it's, when you go back and you look at sort of the history of the program, and Alan Greenspan, who used to be the Federal Reserve Chair, you know, he sort of gained his initial notoriety working on this bipartisan commission back in 1983 that really made the extension, made the sort of solutions to Social Security that have gotten us this far. But You know, you look and see what are the potential solutions, of course, to sort of extend the longevity of Social Security. And, you know, because, of course, it seems totally impracticable to me to believe that whether right or left, you're going to see any meaningful reduction in benefits for the constituency that happens to have the highest voter turnout. And so, you know, I think that it would encounter such absolute outrage that there's just no politician that's going to be elected on the back of the reduction of those benefits, because the argument is a valid one for a lot of the people out there that say, you know, I paid into the system for decades and decades, and now I'm the one that you're going to cheat out of, you know, my out of these promises. So the more politically palatable option, and as I think the probably the, you know, the path of least resistance here, you know, that can, of course, increase the amount of income that is subject to Social Security taxation. That would extend the life of the program. You know, they really need to get through the life expectancy tables and get a lot of boomers off the rolls before they really start making the substantive changes to benefits themselves. But the other ones, of course, are applying Social Security tax to investment income. You know, that, of course, is one of the things that they could do. So, you know, I just don't, and that's going to, of course, have impacts on stock and bond portfolios, but, don't let the fund's projected depletion, really try to motivate your own filing decision. Let your filing decision be motivated, by your personal circumstance. And I think ultimately, you know, have faith, like Churchill said, that Americans will do everything else before they do the right thing. And just know that eventually Congress will come, to the right answer. It's just going to mean that we're going to be like weeks or months away from the program actually being insolvent, because you know that they're going to make the right choices with a gun to their head. They just have to have the gun to their head first. So be confident, make the decision motivated to your personal circumstance and not out of politically motivated fear, because the fear emerges on both right and left. I mean, we talk to everybody and we understand and we see those statements, and it's alarming when you look at it. But know that eventually, you know, there are easy fixes to dramatically increase the length of solvency, and they'll be made eventually. It's just a question of when. There was a Financial Times columnist this week, Ruchir Sharma. He's chair of Rockefeller International. He has some really insightful commentary, and you know, with a new Federal Reserve chair, I just wanted to touch on this really quickly, but his opinion piece, his op-ed said, the populist case for ending easy money now. And we talk so much on the show around sort of what, you know, the K-shaped economy, all these things, you know, monetary policy. Kevin Warsh, our new Federal Reserve chair, is a Milton Friedman style economist who says inflation is a monetary phenomenon anywhere and everywhere, meaning that the expansion of the money supply is ultimately what drives inflation. And, you know, if you've paid attention to the show or to the broader economy, you know, you should know by now that, you know, there's roughly 50% more money in circulation here in 2026 than there was just 6 years ago. The federal balance sheet is still expanding. You know, Kevin Warsh talks about, I think, you know, here's sort of a discredit to the argument of monetary expansion driving the stock market, and that, you know, the balance sheet of the Fed actually shrunk in 2023 to 2025, but the stock market roughly doubled over those over those few years. So it's not the sole phenomenon, I think, driving markets in particular, but, you know, there is absolutely no question that the surplus of money in today's society is looking for places to go. And whether that's real assets in the form of property, speculation in the form of stocks, the rise of so-called traditional assets like cryptocurrency, all of these things are symptomatic of just too much liquidity globally sloshing around in the system. And what we've talked about so much on the show, and what Ruchir Sharma so artfully articulates in this op-ed, is that higher interest rates and tighter money over time force more precise and better capital allocation decisions. And that's when you don't see the rise of 50 different delivery apps or, you know, all of this nonsense that doesn't really have any economic utility. I'm looking at you, cryptocurrency, or all of the peripheral industries around that, because it's tighter monetary policy is ultimately what fixes it all. It just has to last long enough for the fix for us to take our medicine. And so I'm really hopeful, really optimistic that this Warsh Fed can be the start of a new policy regime that ultimately will lead to less populism in the form of confiscatory leftist populists like Zoran Mondami, or sort of the right-wing populism that laughably at these days also sort of resembles Elizabeth Warren, like ending institutional ownership of homes and all this other stuff. But touching on international developed stocks is another thing I wanted to touch on this week. International developed had its moment in the sun last year. The Iran war looked like it was going to completely derail the performance of international stocks this year. But I was very surprised at how resilient international developed markets were in the face of the war. They suffered a little bit more than U.S. markets, but it's very clear that there are increasing flows going to international developed stocks. When you look, higher interest rates in both Japan and Europe as of this week, Japanese Central Bank also raised rates. What it ultimately means, I think, is additional fiscal expenditure by governments there are going to, indebted expansion, trying to create a little degree of strategic autonomy from what, those countries maybe perceive as a less reliable partner in the form of the United States. Means a lot more fiscal spending on goods and services, specifically with domestic content requirements. You just saw France, kick out our AI companies basically for their own home ground version. But we still think developed international stocks should be a hearty allocation in all investor portfolios.
Sign up for our e-news today. Get the latest thoughts on the market every other week from Northwest Quadrant Wealth Management delivered right to your inbox. The short 5 to 6 minute video helps you keep up with the market. You can always watch past videos on northwestquadrantwealth.com.